Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Rich Karlgaard to the broadcast. Rich is the publisher of Forbes magazine, a post he's held since 1998. He also writes the Forbes column Innovation Rules, and he's been a regular panelist on television's Forbes on Fox show since its inception in 2001. Rich is a serial entrepreneur, having launched Upside and Forbes ASAP magazines, the venture capital firm Garage Technology Ventures, and the Silicon Valley's premier business and technology forum, 7,500-member Churchill Club. For this and other achievements, Rich is the past winner of the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Rich just released the number one Amazon bestseller in strategy and competition, The Soft Edge, Where Great Companies Find Lasting Success. He was also the author of Life 2.0, How People Across America Are Transforming Their Lives by Finding the Where of Their Happiness, a Wall Street Journal business bestseller, in 2004. Rich has a BA in political science from Stanford University. I recently caught up with Rich in San Francisco, and our conversation covered world-class IT principle one, people, as we discussed his latest book, The Soft Edge, and the importance of culture in the success of great companies and the factors that great leaders have in common, as well as a variety of other topics.
The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Red Hat, the world's leading open source solutions provider. Learn more at redhat.com.
Rich Karlgaard, welcome to the Forum on World Class IT.
Thank you, Peter.
First of all, I want to start by congratulating you on a terrific book, The Soft Edge, Where Great Companies Find Lasting Success. And I thought we'd begin with the genesis of the idea behind the book, the whole notion of the soft edge. Can you describe what the soft edge is and maybe a bit about how the notion came to mind?
Well, sure. We're recording this in mid-May 2014, and next month is an anniversary having to do with the economy that nobody's going to take note of. It's the fifth year of the end of the Great Recession. The U.S. economy went into recovery in June 2009, and yet 70% of Americans still think we're in a recession. Now, you ask yourself, why is that? Well, number one, economic growth overall hasn't been that robust. We've averaged 2% GDP growth on an annual basis over those 5 years. We've seen fits and starts in the economy. There was no growth at all in the first quarter of 2014. We're looking at 3% growth, perhaps, if we're lucky, for the rest of the year. And this is just not historically very good. Since the end of World War II through the present, the American economy has averaged 3% annual growth. That's inclusive of 11 recessions, including the nasty one we just went through, including an equally nasty one in 73 and 74, including some really short but sharp ones, such as the one in 1982, or mostly regional recessions, such as the one that Los Angeles went through from 1988 to 1994. The fact that the U.S. economy has grown at 3% despite all of those things means that 2% growth now is not very robust. But there's another story to the economy, and it gets to this why 70% think we're still in a recession, and that is this economic recovery is incredibly uneven. It's as if post-recession that the entire economy has been put into this centrifuge and it's spinning faster and faster, and 70% of people are winding up here and 30% are winding up in a pretty good place. So the 70% that say we're still in a recession, one of three things is possible. Number one, they don't have a job. Number two, they're stuck in their job. Number three, they're working for a company that is stuck. And I decided after seeing these statistics and hearing these stories that I wanted to get out there and find out what are the 30% doing? What are the companies that are unstuck doing? Now, I've lived my whole adult life in Silicon Valley. I arrived here to go to school in the mid-70s. So I've seen multiple generations of Silicon Valley's history, from personal computers to network computing in the late 80s and early 90s, to Internet 1.0 in the late 90s, to everything we have today. I wanted to get outside of Silicon Valley to do the research for this book. I wanted to talk to companies large and small, publicly traded and privately held, across a broad range of industries to see if there were extractable principles that these unstuck high-performing companies, what were they doing that was different? And I particularly wanted to look at companies that had faced trouble before and made recoveries. So I wasn't looking at superstar companies like Google that have yet to be tested, in my opinion, but companies that have been around for decades, such as FedEx, for more than a century, such as Northwestern Mutual or Mayo Clinic, bicycle companies like Specialized, to a couple of Silicon Valley companies such as Nest Labs and NetApp, but really this broad variety. That's the research that I did.
I've covered both in the podcast as well as in my writings for Forbes a number of IT executives who've penetrated the boards of major companies, and therefore the companies who were to a greater extent seeing the value of having a strong technology voice at the board level, whether it's talking about innovation, talking about security, talking about a growing number of both opportunities and threats to be thinking about it in board level conversations. You speak an awful lot with CEOs of companies, and I wonder if you can provide the flip side of that perspective as to what you're seeing in companies that have, to a great extent, valued that perspective at the board level.
Sure. You know, the best example of that happens to be one of my favorite CEOs, and that's Fred Smith. Great entrepreneur, great CEO, great board chairman, great strategic thinker. Fred started FedEx in 1971. Now it's $50 billion in revenue size. And even if you're an investor, you got to like it that FedEx has outperformed the S&P 500 over the last 1, 3, 5, and 10-year periods. So even as a somewhat mature company that's more than 40 years old, it still outperforms the market as a whole. I got the most amazing story from Fred when I was visiting him in Memphis and sitting in his private office. And it has everything to do with how he values IT and the role of the CIO as part of FedEx's strategic thinking, not just its operation, but central to its strategy. And FedEx, as you know, has one of the great CIOs today, Rob Carter. But I want to take you back to the late 1980s, and FedEx senses that it has a problem. FedEx, as you know, does two things supremely well. One is visible, one is invisible. The visible thing, of course, is keeping all of those aircraft and trucks in motion. And the invisible thing is the information system that makes it possible. So FedEx doesn't succeed, and it doesn't compete against UPS and others unless it does both of those things really well. It's the late 1980s, and FedEx's COO slash CIO, a guy named Jim Barksdale, is very worried. He's very worried about this transition that he can see coming from the era of mainframe computing to the era of network computing, and that if FedEx didn't get this right, then it would lose. It would become not as competitive in that invisible stuff that I mentioned earlier, the information system that makes it all work. Oh, sure, it would all work, but it wouldn't work quite as well, and there would be a huge cost penalty for not getting this transition right. Now, Jim Barksdale was the CIO and then had become the COO, had kept the CIO title, and he was on the board of directors at FedEx. So Fred Smith has always liked having a CIO on the board of directors. That tells you a lot about how Fred values the IT role. And Jim Barksdale felt that he had permission to come to Fred with a problem and not have his head bitten off. So what Jim Barksdale did was, Fred said, well, you figure it out. You're a creative guy. Jim Barksdale got together with another FedEx board member, an investor out of New York named Phil Greer, and the two of them had investments in Silicon Valley with some of these network computing startups. They traveled to Silicon Valley, and they met whom they thought was the brightest person of all in Silicon Valley in this new emerging world of network computing, and it was a 36-year-old woman named Judy Estrin, who had started a company with her husband, Bill Carrico. The company is called Bridge Communications. Eventually, it was bought by Cisco. So they asked Judy, would you think about being on FedEx's board of directors? Well, she'd never served on a public board of directors at all in her life, or any board of directors for that matter, other than Bridge. Well, come back and see, interview Fred and see what you think. She flew from Silicon Valley to Memphis, met Fred Smith, said she was terrified. Fred has this kind of military bearing, very crisp manner of talk. He's a nice guy, but he's outwardly, he's kind of a tough guy. And from Fred's perspective, he said, this is the brightest person I've ever talked to. She just is illuminating, effervescent. He pronounced her blindingly brilliant and asked her to be on the board of directors. But here's the great thing, is that he changed his board of directors to make the right position possible for Judy. Now, on boards of directors in most publicly traded companies, even today, the IT role is part of the audit committee. That tells you that no matter what a company says about the strategic role of IT, at the board level, it's subservient to finance. It's the handmaiden of finance. It exists in the minds of board of directors to keep the numbers accurate so the directors don't go to jail when the SEC comes. And what a crabbed view of the strategic potential of IT. Well, Fred immediately saw it, and he knew that if he was going to recruit Judy, he had to do something special. So he created the IT Oversight and Strategy Committee and had her chair it. She chaired it for 22 years, was on the board of directors. Her service on FedEx's board level also got the attention of other boards, and she's been on Disney's board for several years and still sits on Disney's board. That's how valuable Judy Estrin is. But if Fred didn't have an empowered CIO who was also on the board of directors, and if Fred didn't see that IT should not be trapped by the audit committee if it's to see its full value, you know, none of this would have happened.
Great example. The fact that it's an example that is so long ago speaks to how progressive that organization has thought about technology for so long.
Somebody sitting here in the progressive San Francisco Bay Area might look down their nose at a company based in Memphis, Tennessee, and it just couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, in many ways, it can be the opposite. Progressive nature, the Valley in San Francisco, ends up covering up a lot of sins. Twitter went public in 2013 with an all-white male board of directors. Are you kidding me? Here, Fred Smith openly acknowledged in the late 80s, and Jim Barksdale said, you know, we're not the center of the computing universe, and we're making this transition from big iron to network computing, and we don't have all the expertise here. We're going to get outside of ourselves and look for it. And they found a woman who, in many ways, wouldn't fit people's preconception of what a good old Memphis boy culture was all about. So they brought Judy Estrin in, and she served magnificently. And Fred speaks fondly of her today, and she speaks fondly of Fred. Actually, I was sitting talking to Fred in August 2013, and suddenly this idea of a triangle came into my head, because Fred was talking about the importance of strategy. And he said, you can do everything right, but if you miss a big strategic change in your industry or you make a bad strategic bet, it can all be for naught. He used Digital Equipment Corporation Computing. He used Lockheed in commercial aircraft. And so he's talking about the importance of strategy. And we've been talking about the importance of execution and the importance of culture. And all of a sudden, this image of a triangle popped into my head, that great companies are good in three areas. They're really good about their strategy. They're thoughtful about their strategy. They know what business they're in. They know who their customers are. They know who their potential customers are, so people aren't buying from them. They've figured out why. They know who their competitors are. They know what the substitutes for their products and services are. This is a key insight, because if people aren't buying from you or your competitors, how are they fulfilling the need for your product or service? They're really good at thinking about disruptive threats coming over the horizon. Execution. Great companies don't waste money. They don't waste time. They use all the computational and data and analytical tools that are available to them. They have world-class supply chains. They're world-class about logistics. They're very efficient in the use of their capital. An example would be Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines is a great performing company, but Southwest Airlines, just on this point of capital efficiency, could make one bad bet hedging fuel prices for the next 5 years, and it would undo all the other great things that they do. So you have to be very efficient about the use of your capital. And if you stop there, Peter, and you say, if you're really good about strategy and you're really good about execution, you can get a long ways as a company, particularly in good economic times. But when the economic uncertainties come, or there's been the arrival of some new massively disruptive players in your industry, what's to prevent your customers from fleeing, your best employees from revolting, and your shareholders from being really angry and impatient about your progress? And that's where you go to this third side of the triangle, the cultural values, what I call the soft edge, where you find, even though this is the side of a business that's harder to measure, It's where you find deep trust, great teams, great stories, customer stickiness, and the things that great companies are able to do year by year, decade by decade. I was thinking about this also in the context. You know, there's a great analogy here. The UN uses this diagnostic tool called the Triangle of Health. Now, imagine you're a doctor going into an impoverished area in India or Africa or someplace, and you've got to see 1,000 patients in a week. Really, all you can do is triage. And how do you do that? Well, you spend 5 or 10 minutes with a patient, and you say, according to the Triangle of Health, does this person have reasonably good physical health? Are they mobile? Do they look healthy? Check off the box. They're physically healthy. In conversation, do they appear to be mentally healthy? Do they have a grip on reality? Can they plan into the future? Mental health doesn't mean that you're happy all the time. It simply means you're taking life as it is and you can deal with it. And then the third side is social health. You could be physically healthy and mentally healthy, but if you have crime at home, you have violence at home, you have no rule of law, you live in Damascus, Syria, say, despite having great physical health and mental health, your prospects of long-term health are jeopardized. So this idea of a triangle, of a dynamic balance of forces, is what I tried to get across in the book, The Soft Edge, with particular emphasis on the most neglected side, the side of cultural values.
And it's interesting, Rich, that this is at a time where one of the edges, at least, especially as it comes to ideas like data analytics and the use of metrics and just data, generally speaking, to a much more dramatic extent than in past decades, perhaps. That side, if you will, has become so gaining sort of religious fervor among a lot of organizations, and perhaps in some cases are at the expense of the soft edge type characteristics that you're describing. How do you think about the balance or imbalance relative to those topics?
What's interesting is when you study the history of organizations, we've had this debate before. For instance, there was a chap named Frederick Taylor who wrote a seminal book on scientific management in 1911, I believe. And he wrote in the introduction, he said, in the past, man was first, the future, the system must be first. And it was all about taking stopwatches and clipboards and watching the actions of workers on the factory floor and noting where wastage was occurring and trying to turn people into replaceable components. It was an ideal marriage of Taylor's ideas and Henry Ford's assembly lines that gave Ford a great advantage in the early days of automobile manufacturing from the Model T through about the 1930s. Then we've seen another great wave of analytics that came out of World War II, represented by Robert McNamara. Robert McNamara was one of these young geniuses in World War II that planned bombing routes and saved fuel and saved airplanes and saved lives because of all of that. He and some of his analytic superstars from the Air Force then went into Ford Motor Company. They were called the Whiz Kids. Ford, by now, in the 1950s, was getting its behind whipped by General Motors under Alfred Sloan. And the Whiz Kids fixed Ford. In a way, they fixed Ford. They fixed the finances. They fixed the operations. They even birthed a new car called the Ford Falcon, which was the ultimate utilitarian analytics-driven car. Low cost of purchase, low fuel consumption, and so forth. No passion or soul whatever. And then Robert McNamara was drafted into the John F. Kennedy administration and became the architect of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. After Kennedy's death, McNamara's Secretary of Defense worked with LBJ, and his analytics said that the U.S. could win a war of attrition against the Viet Cong, and therefore the proper strategy was called graduated escalation. And he took the troop count from 18,000 up to over 500,000, thinking the Viet Cong would fold at any minute, completely discounting the fact that the Viet Cong, as impoverished as they were by our standards, were very resourceful, and completely discounting the fact that some of our best allies and that the U.S. media would abandon the effort. And so here's the danger of a purely analytic, data-driven view of the world, that you still see what you want to see. And absent these deeper cultural values, absent human agency, absent how humans respond to things, you can run off a cliff with this. I actually think it's happening with some companies today. One of the great entrepreneurs of our day is Jeff Bezos of Amazon. Amazon is now an $80 billion a year company by revenue run rate. They're now a consistent $20 billion quarter company. In March, the stock market killed them when they, once again, didn't report much of a profit. Small companies, companies earlier in their growth phase, will get the benefit of the doubt. You're a growth company, we get it, don't report a profit, we like to see the top line growth. Amazon's lived off of that for quite a long time. The company is 15, 16, 17 years old now, and is still treated as a growth company. As one of my analyst friends on Wall Street told me, Wall Street thinks you're a growth company until suddenly they don't think so. And suddenly your PE reverts to the market average. Amazon's PE is still trading above the market average, largely because it doesn't have much of an E. But the market is getting a little tired of Amazon's growth at the expense of profitability. Well, Amazon is a very tough culture. Jeff Bezos is a taskmaster, very focused. He works hard himself, so he's not at all hypocritical about this. Very, very, very analytics driven. One of the things is when you dig deeper into the Amazon story is that they have the highest employee turnover rate, both in technology and in retail. And in fact, they have the highest employee turnover rate of all American companies of note, except for Massachusetts Mutual, the insurance company. Now, insurance companies, it's simply somebody tries their hand at selling insurance and 3 months later they figure out they're not cut out for it. So it's natural that they have high turnover rates. Well, this is costing Amazon. Amazon's analytics are telling it to run the company one way. Humans are responding in a different way. I predict that the first major technology company that will have union workers will be Amazon. Amazon will pay the price for treating people as Frederick Taylor and Henry Ford treated people 100 years ago. So you can make a mistake when you're not well balanced. And my analysis of Amazon, for everything they've achieved and for all of Jeff Bezos' heroic accomplishments, they are out of balance as a company right now.
Fascinating. You mentioned earlier that Google, obviously a fantastic company that has been for quite some time now, hasn't really been tested. And you live in this area where there are a lucky few organizations who become talent magnets that are sort of the hot companies of the day. Perhaps Facebook and Google would fit the bill today, just as Microsoft and HP did in years past. But there's this period during the rapid growth, especially pre-IPO, where people are very excited about these financial events that are off in the future, and it keeps people motivated, it keeps people locked to the company for obvious reasons. And then a combination of the event happening, growth slowing, and all of a sudden it becomes a more difficult place to keep your best talent, as well as to continue to be that talent magnet that the organization once was. First of all, do you agree with that analysis?
I agree with it totally, Peter. Many have been the companies that have confused a rising stock price with a great culture. Dell was an example of that company. Dell was a pretty tough, high turnover culture, and yet Dell's stock went up 1,000-fold in the 1990s. It was the fastest growing stock of that decade, and it worked until it didn't work anymore. Right now, Amazon's market value is still somewhere close to $200 billion. So the idea that Amazon's market cap is going to double from here becomes maybe, but not likely. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Amazon's had a lot of employees over the years that have watched their options increase tenfold, maybe 50-fold, maybe 100-fold. Now you're looking at a new generation where a mere double is a big, big lift. And at that point, you start losing the next generation of the best and brightest people unless you have that great culture to attract them. Same thing happened at Microsoft. The best and brightest people always worked at Microsoft. Bill Gates told me to my face back in 1993 when I spent some time with them. But I think the Bill, as bright as he is, was confusing a rising stock price with what really got people excited. When Microsoft was had a market cap of over $600 billion in late 1999, and now it's around $250 billion today, despite having four times the revenue it did in 1999. And if Microsoft is honest with itself, it's not the talent magnet that it was. The new CEO is going to have to work to repair the culture. Google, of all the high flyers, I think has done a really good job of thinking about corporate culture along the way. They nearly always make every magazine's list of the best places to work are in the top 10. It's not just the campus with all the freebies and and the massages and the cool-looking bicycles and so forth. It's real things that improve people's lives, the buses, the laundromats, but it's also this culture of trust. So of all the new companies that have benefited by rising stock price, Google has done the most, in my view, to not confuse the two, knowing there will be a day when the stock price flattens and that a mere doubling of the stock price would be a big achievement. And at that point, who's going to work for you below market rates?
Exactly. So we began this conversation with you mentioning that you, although you didn't put it this way, but you got out of the bubble of Silicon Valley and got into the heartland and went to places like Wisconsin and Minnesota to meet with organizations like Northwest Mutual and Mayo, as opposed to the Facebooks or the Googles of this world. It's interesting that you found companies that are not necessarily the first ones that you think about in terms of sexy organizations, but in fact, that's partially the secret, that they've never been in style, but never out of style, if you will.
I think the company that blew me away the most, Peter, in the research for this book is Northwestern Mutual, based in Milwaukee. It's been around since 1857, $25 billion in revenue, $225 billion in assets, $1.5 trillion in contracts. That sounds like they're really leveraged, but actually they have the best ratio in the industry. And one of the things that really attracted me about Northwestern Mutual is I tried to think of the white-collar job that would be the worst job in the world. There are plenty of bad blue-collar jobs, smelly jobs, dangerous jobs, dirty jobs. But what would be a bad white-collar job? And for someone wired as I am, I thought that getting up in every day and having to make 10 cold calls, which is what insurance agents do, to get 3 meetings if you're lucky, to get 1 new customer out of it if you're really lucky and really good, and doing that every day for your whole career would be really tough. And I wanted to know what would get people to commit to a career like that and to see if there would be something that Northwestern Mutual was doing that their competitors weren't doing, and to see if, in fact, this is a durable industry. It's been around for 157 years, but is this an industry that Wall Street or Silicon Valley could disrupt? Because after all, we're just simply talking about actuarial probabilities and then creating some kind of algorithm to run those probabilities, and that's the insurance business. Well, Northwestern Mutual has 10,000 commissioned sales reps. Some do really well. Maybe 5,000 are still struggling to get a real footing. And how that company creates trust and creates conviction and creates people who commit to their career for the long term is just an amazing thing. It doesn't do it with people coming out of Wharton or Harvard Business School or Stanford Business School. It does it with military veterans, often combat veterans. It does it with people who've been laid off of previous careers. It does it with a lot of women whose first marriage didn't work, whose first husband was a bum, and now all of a sudden they have to figure out how they're going to feed and clothe and educate their children. Northwestern Mutual finds these exceptionally gritty people from gritty places in life, and they create this conviction, the likes of which I haven't seen. They've got a CEO, John Schlifske. They've always hired the CEO internally. He's a good old Wisconsin guy. He looks like a retired Green Bay Packer, though he isn't, but a big man, a warm man, off the charts in empathy, but a very good financial head too. It's a wonder to see. I attended their sales conference last year in Milwaukee, and if Wall Street companies, New York companies, and California companies kind of like to emphasize the hip and the snarky, the kind of the secret dog whistles and handshakes to show that you're cool, this company does the opposite. It's almost like hearing, in the language spoken at that conference, it's almost like opening up a book like Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill or The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale. That's how they talk. That's what they really believe. I got this vision. It was like an army of George Baileys, the character played by Jimmy Stewart in the movie It's a Wonderful Life. That's the kind of earnestness that they go forward with, and they do it consistently every day. And so diving in and try to figure out the Northwestern culture that would inspire people to do that and create this enormous trust both within the company with the salespeople and externally, that was a revelation to me, because you don't see that many companies out there doing yet, and yet the benefits seem to be so clear.
You've said that, in essence, the soft edge is the only competitive advantage of lasting companies, which would seem to suggest that if you do this well, then the other benefits come. If you are going to focus on getting one of these right first, this is an area really to make sure that you are getting right. Is that correct?
Well, I'm going to be clear about this, Peter. There are people out there who will say that culture trumps everything. In fact, on stage last week at an event, I was interviewing Howard Behar, who was the president of Starbucks from 1989 to 2003. And he was really the number two under Howard Schultz. Howard Schultz grew up very poor, grew up in the projects in the outer boroughs of New York, very, very driven, very focused, very goal-oriented. But like a lot of entrepreneurs, like Steve Jobs, like Jeff Bezos, like Bill Gates during his heyday, not really that great on empathy and all of those softer virtues. Howard Schultz had the vision to give Howard Behar all the latitude Howard Behar wanted to create this great culture, because as Starbucks was growing fast, they were reaching these inflection points where they were in danger of blowing up. Suddenly there would be a wave over a six-month period of a lot of turnover in their employee force, or the surveys would show that people were falling out of love with Starbucks. And so Howard said, we've got to emphasize till the ends of the earth. If we're going to put a Starbucks in every city block, on all four corners of every city block of every city in the world, if we're going to scale like that, this still has to be a magical experience, which means the culture has to matter a lot here. So Starbucks, they found this interesting dynamic balance between a very driven CEO and the cultural values. You still have to have a great strategy. You still have to execute well. If you don't have those cultural values, though, you become fragile. You become fragile when the luck runs out on your stock price. You become fragile if there's a disruption to your industry. A company that you and I both really admire, and the CEO that you and I both really admire, SAS, the analytics company in Cary, North Carolina, $3 billion in revenue, privately held company. And that's part of the reason I think they can put so much emphasis in cultural values. Jim Goodnight, my goodness, you know, one of the epic figures in software. He walks and he talks like John Wayne, and he's created this wonderful campus. They do it all. The company gets a lot of attention for the soft values. They're a company that also makes the list of world's best places to work. There's the obvious reason why they make it. They have this great campus with an Olympic-sized swimming pool and childcare, a great cafeteria and art hanging on the walls and sculptures in the yards and beautiful grounds and so forth. But when I talk to Jim Goodnight and talk to Jim Davis, the CMO, who's really the number two at SAS, they thought it was all about trust, that all of the magazines love to report on all of these visual depictions of a great place to work. But for them, at the end of the day, it was about trust. And it came to a very simple idea that if you're going to recruit these PhDs in statistical sciences, the best of the best around the world, whether they give you their best ideas or not is still up for grabs. Nobody's going to share their best ideas if they don't trust that their employers are going to make good use of those ideas and reward the person for sharing those ideas. And that's what it's really all about at SAS. So they set out every year telling themselves, we want to make it again. We want to make the top five again. What is it going to take for us to do it again? And they keep drilling down to this trust more than anything else. And that's why it's a great enduring company. I do think they have an advantage being a privately held company, that it's easier to invest in these softer edge values. As Tom Peters, who wrote In Search of Excellence, along with Bob Waterman, back in 1982, the best-selling business book of all time for many years. But Tom Peters says, soft is hard. Hard is actually the easy thing to do because the metrics will support you, right? The financials are there. They're transparent. Everyone can see it. The investment in computational equipment and data and analytics, it's there. You get an ROI or you don't. You can measure it. It doesn't take guts to invest in that. It just, you have to invest in it. It takes guts to invest in a really good, strong culture that is going to be there even when luck runs out on the stock price, that is going to be there if a new, hip, young competitor comes into the field and starts disrupting the heck out of you. Are your customers, are your employees, are your shareholders going to stick with you then? And they will if you have a culture, not forever. But these great cultures buy grace periods, and that's why you see these companies that have been around for decades have these great cultures, because they're all going to run into problems at some time or another, and they're all going to run into that period where they are going to have their best employees stay around, their best customers give them a little extra time to figure it out, and have their shareholders be patient about the transformation.
I always found it's refreshing that SAS, of course, is in the business of analytics. Of course, they have a whole cadre of analytics they use to evaluate how well their team is doing and performance and all these sorts of things. But just as you say, despite the fact that that is their bread and butter business-wise, they pay at least as much attention to the soft edge characteristics that you've described and do so to great benefit.
Well, the good news for the more quantitative people who are listening to this is that I think there are a lot of interesting tools and techniques that can link the soft edge to performance in a more direct way. And SAS is doing one of them, and that's visual analytics. Typically in a corporation, people who are left brain analytical go into finance, they go into IT, they go into operations. It's just naturally where they excel. The right brain people, let's call them hippies, tend to go into marketing and HR and design and those kinds of things that have been more commonly found on the soft edge. There's always been a little bit of this Venus-Mars tension that runs between the two. I have great hope for visual analytics, because what visual analytics can do is to get right brain people and left brain people sitting in the same room, agreeing on what the challenge is and agreeing on what some of the strategies that make sense and paths forward that make sense will be. This is a great common language for inside of organizations. You know, another great tool and technique that I discovered just a week ago, I wish I would have had in the book, is the importance of simulation and then really good debriefing sessions after a task has been accomplished. I interviewed on stage a flight instructor for the Navy Blue Angels. Now, you talk about having to execute to precision. Some of these routines done by the Blue Angels are flying 500 miles an hour, wingtip to wingtip. The wingtips are only 18 inches apart, and so the smallest errors can lead to catastrophe. And there have been some catastrophes. So how do they make sure that they don't have those catastrophes? Well, they simulate the heck out of it. All the time, they're either practicing for real, or they're simulating it on simulators, or they're simulating it by way of talking about what they're going to do. Just vast preparation in the beginning. But what they also do that's really cool is that they debrief. They debrief every simulation, they debrief every practice, and they debrief every performance. When they come into the debriefing room, they're all wearing their flight suits, and their names and their rank are attached to the flight suits by Velcro, and they pull them off so that there's no hierarchy, so everybody can say, you know, what we did right and what I think I did wrong and needs improvement. And they have a saying in these debriefing sessions, there has never been a perfect performance. So let's talk about what we did that was imperfect today. You know, maybe it was we deviated and we were flying 12 inches apart instead of 18 inches apart. Well, another 12 inches and now you've got a catastrophe on your hand. They even debrief how they march out to the plane because they want to put themselves in a mind frame where they're doing everything with precision before they even get into their planes and take off. So I think we're at the dawn of an era where there will be tools and techniques that are going to give validation to soft edge virtues. I just came from a conference where big data and predictive analytics can really help a company hold on to its customers. It can measure. It can tell you when a customer is about to bolt. It can give you all of these little telltale signs that this customer needs more loving care and all that kind of stuff. But it's also going to guide the conclusion that companies are going to make, I believe, from this software, is if we had a great culture, we're going to be addressing this issue far fewer times than if we have this kind of sloppy, unempathetic culture that we have now. So I believe that the two are going to come together in interesting ways.
I want to talk a little bit about your career arc, Rich. You've been involved in so many different areas. Obviously, you're today the publisher of Forbes. You have started two magazines, Upside and ASAP, within the Forbes banner. You've been involved in venture capital, the Garage Technology Ventures. You also founded Silicon Valley's premier business and technology forum, a 7,500-member strong organization referred to as the Churchill Club. Is there a thread that runs through all of those things? How would you define kind of the areas of interest that you've gotten yourself involved in? It seems like there's aspects of it that are entrepreneurial, whether they're your own ventures or helping others start their own. There's storytelling, which has been in full blossom, certainly in this conversation. And then also bringing together people who might benefit from getting to know one another. How do you sort of think about the way in which you've managed your own career?
Well, I've been lucky. I made a disastrous decision in majoring in political science, which of course has no utility, even back in the day when I had a majored in poli-sci. And no surprise, I spent the first several years of my quote-unquote career just trying to stay alive. Occasionally, I would have a fairly good job. I was a assistant editor at Runner's World magazine back in the day. And then I would lapse back and I would be doing things like doing security guard work and temporary typing just to stay alive. When I was in my late 20s, I got married, which gave me a new sense of responsibility. My wife worked at a startup bank called Silicon Valley Bank. One of her colleagues had a lot of things in common with me in terms of our interests. And we got together and we had this idea, even though the both of us were not connected in the Silicon Valley at all to any of the power structures, let's start an organization where we would be able to do that. So we started this organization called the Churchill Club. And sometimes you get lucky. We asked the great Bob Noyce, who was the co-inventor of the integrated circuit, the co-founder of Fairchild Semiconductor, co-founder of Intel, and its chairman at the time, if he would speak at an event, and then we would use this new technology called desktop publishing, and we would do flyers and things like that. It worked. He said yes, and we rented space at a club, and we had to turn away people. We had 300 people who turned out to see this speech by Bob Noyce. The Churchill Club was now underway. This was in 1985. Well, my colleague's name is Tony Perkins. Tony and I next decided that we would start a magazine. And the magazine we started was going to be on Silicon Valley. And we felt that even though there were a lot of technology magazines, there was no magazine that was writing about startups and venture capital and investment banking and the process of going public and high growth companies and all of that. And we started Upside again with the technology of desktop publishing. And it made a big splash to the point where 3 years after the founding, I was getting four-hour interviews with the likes of Bill Gates and so forth, but we just couldn't quite figure out how to make money. Some new investors came in and crammed down our personal stakes in Upside. We each went from 30% ownership to 3% ownership in one fell swoop. And at that point, I accepted Steve Forbes' offer to start a similar magazine for Forbes, which we called Forbes ASAP. And my friend Tony went on to start a publication called Red Herring, which did really well in the 1990s. Steve Forbes gave me carte blanche with Forbes ASAP. It was a technology futurist magazine, started out as a quarterly, and then went to a bi-monthly that would give Forbes subscribers a glimpse into the future. By this time, I'd become really good friends with the futurist George Gilder. So we decided to build Forbes ASAP around George Gilder's prophecies. George Gilder had a book that had done really well called Microcosm on the semiconductor industry, and he was working on a new book called Telecosm. And George wrote some great pieces predicting some amazing things that came true. He predicted the rise of a company called Qualcomm, that Qualcomm would eventually dominate mobile computing. George is writing this in 1992, saying that Intel's technology was not properly configured for mobile. George was writing about digital wallets and mobile video and things like that back in 1992. And we enjoyed great success from that. So I think the most fun I had was in 1996, we decided to have an annual issue where writers who don't ordinarily write on technology would write big pieces on this phenomenon called the internet. And we were able to get writers like Tom Wolfe and John Updike. And it's still one of the highlights of my career is to be able to work on a 9,000-word piece with the great Tom Wolfe. He dresses like Tom Wolfe even in his own home. He lives on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I still remember his dress. It's 21 East 79th Street, so a block off of Central Park on the East Side. And he greets you in this, you know, great two-story brownstone, tall ceilings and floor-to-ceiling libraries. And he comes out and he greets you, and he's dressed like Tom Wolfe in his own home with the high starch collars and the big polka dot ties and
We're talking about media, of course, and your own personal evolution in it. There are few industries that are going through such a dynamic change right now, and certainly a lot of that is imbued with the whole topic of technology, another area of interest of yours, as you've mentioned. I know that you are not necessarily a futurist, but you study these things personally and professionally, and I wonder if you can offer some thoughts about the future of media, and what excites you, and where you see the dynamics today?
Sure, it would be less than truthful if I said that it hasn't been a challenge over the past several years for incumbent media companies like Forbes. We've navigated it pretty well. But just to put this into context, when I joined Forbes in 1992 to start Forbes ASAP, and I went to our first annual sales meeting, our salespeople all looked the same. They were all tall, silver-haired men of a certain age who looked like they'd just come off the 18th hole of a country club golf course. And they were great Forbes salespeople because all they had to do was show up and not even ask for the order, typically just be there with their hand out to get the order. And I remember again, in 1998, I was running Forbes ASAP out of our Bay Area office, and we would have parties. And a who's who of people would show up at our parties, celebrities trying to get in on the internet boom, the skater Peggy Fleming, people like that would just sort of show up trying to figure out what was going on. And at one of the parties in 1998, Larry Page and Sergey Brin showed up, founders of Google. Now in 1998, Forbes and Forbes ASAP, we were as thick as phone books. So much advertising money was flowing around that all you had to do was stand by the fax machine and the insertion orders would roll in. If I had been as smart as you mistakenly think I am, in 1998, I would have begged Sergey Brin and Larry Page for a job. I would have walked away from this party with Silver Oak Merlot and all of these fancy things. And even, you know, Peggy Fleming, who was my crush when she won the Olympic gold medal as a skater, I would have walked away from it all and joined Google because, of course, Google has completely disrupted the advertising market. And unless you have Google's scale and reach, you have to find a different way of competing because none of us can compete. A legacy media company cannot compete if the average CPM, cost per thousand eyeballs, on the internet, if the average is 25 cents or 50 cents or whatever it is. Legacy media companies like Forbes come from a world where your CPM is 30 or 40 or 50. You're paying $50 for an ad in Forbes magazine for every 1,000 people, and you know, with a million circulation, it's a $50,000 ad. Now, we're not 50 anymore, but we're not 25 cents either. Our challenge at Forbes is to both grow, and we've been able to hold it just under a million for the magazine. Forbes.com is now 60 million uniques per month. That's really impressive for a legacy media company. It's not impressive when you compare it to Google and Facebook and others. And it's not a fair comparison either, but it's just showing you the challenge out there. So the business model challenge of Forbes is to still be able to command a premium price for the information that we deliver, whether it's through the magazine, through Forbes.com, through our conferences, and through other non-advertising ways that we are tapping into the power of the Forbes brand. The Forbes brand is bigger than our revenue stream. The Forbes brand is just, it's a recognizable name around the world, particularly in places that are coming into capitalism for the first time. So ironically enough, Forbes has this huge power in Southeast Asia, in Eastern Europe, in parts of South America, in the Middle East, and I think soon in Africa, because kind of our more undiluted support of free enterprise is really appreciated in these people who've been deprived of the opportunity to have that for a long time. Still, it's a dynamic company. It's an interesting company. We find that our growth is coming in different areas around the world, in online, in licensing the Forbes name to online education opportunities, all kinds of different ways that you couldn't have conceived 20 years ago. And we've managed to come through this transition in pretty good shape. I don't think we'll ever have the margins that we had in the 1990s when we were throwing these lavish parties. No legacy media company ever will again. They're just not there. They never will be there again. But it's a very challenging and interesting time to be alive. I'm very loyal to the Forbes family and to the managers who are running Forbes now. It's an exciting time to be there. And I think that we have a good suite of products that are out in the marketplace and doing well now.
Well, Rich Karlgaard, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and telling us a bit about the lessons from your book, the journey that you've been through in your own personal business career. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Peter, for having me. What a great series of podcasts you've been able to put together.
The Forum on World Class IT would like to thank Red Hat, the world's leading provider of open source solutions, for being our corporate sponsor. Red Hat is a catalyst in communities of customers, contributors, and partners creating better technology the open source way. Connect to an ecosystem of innovation at redhat.com today to learn more. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.